dear listeners. Welcome to another episode of Follow Your Path. My name is Abdul Abed, and I'm a surgical pathology fellow at the University of Pittsburgh Medical Center. Today, our guest is Dr. Sarah Bean. She is a professor of pathology at York University. I am also joined today by a future pathologist, Meredith Herman. Welcome to the show, Dr. Bean.
Thank you.
So starting off, can you please tell us a little bit about yourself, where you grew up, where you went to medical school, and did your residency?
Sure. So I grew up in a very small town in the state of West Virginia. The town is called Moorefield. So it's just this tiny little speck on the map. And when I was there, there was literally one traffic light, probably more deer than humans. The place has blossomed somewhat since I have left, and I think there are probably 5 to 10 traffic lights. It was a great place to grow up, and I still love to go home and visit. Nonetheless, I wanted to sort of, you know, explore the country and see what other places had to offer. So I went to undergrad and to medical school at the University of Rochester in Rochester, New York. And that too was a really great place to be. My path is somewhat nonlinear in the theme of follow your path. It's hard to follow my path. Maybe it looks kind of like these zigzags on your screen, actually. When I was a third year medical student, that's when we start doing our clinical rotations in the old school way of learning medicine. And I was having a hard time finding sort of my passion in medicine. And then I got to surgery, and one day the surgeon plunked out the specimen and said, "Oh, we've got to take this to pathology for a frozen." I was like, "What is that? That sounds really interesting. May I please break scrub and go see, what this is about?" And so I went into the lab, to search path lab, saw a frozen, and it's like, you know, it was this major moment in my life when I realized, wow, pathology is, it could be where it's at. So from there, I decided, well, I'm going to do a post-sophomore fellowship in pathology. So I did it between third and fourth years of medical school. And at that time, that year still counted toward residency by the American Board of Pathology. So once I finished medical school, went back to my fourth year, and then I went to residency at University of Alabama at Birmingham. And Birmingham is just a wonderful place. And you might have figured out that I got tired of the snow and gray skies, and I wanted, you know, hot, sunny weather. And so that's where I headed. And as I said, UAB was just terrific. Again, my path was nonlinear. During my second, so I was like, technically it would have been my third year in residency, but I was there for 2 years. I ended up being chief resident, and I knew I wanted to do cytology. I had, you know, caught the cytology bug and realized, oh gosh, this is the stuff. I need to do cyto in my life and for my life. And they were looking for a fellow, and Dr. Altoom said, "Hey, Sarah, you know, would you like to do your fellowship out of order?" And so I thought about it, and I was like, you know what? Sure, let's do it. So I was chief resident and cyto fellow. And then I went back and did one more year of residency. And then I graduated residency. And this was the unpleasant part, which was I took APCP boards in, whenever you take it, like May, June, whatever. And then just a couple months later, I took my cyto boards. So that was hard, but, you know, it worked out.
Wow, what a journey. And those post-sophomore fellowships are amazing. I also did one myself in Toledo, and can attest, it is a wonderful experience. And unfortunately, it doesn't count towards residency anymore. So I missed that. But, that sounds like a great opportunity to take a fellowship during residency as well. Mm-hmm. So can you share with us a particular faculty member who inspired you towards pathology or cytopathology?
So I'm going to take this from the cytopathology perspective. I was thinking about this. Thank you for sending the list of questions ahead. That was really helpful. And as I was pondering how I would respond, it occurred to me, number one, I'm not a person who really thinks in superlatives. So I don't have like a favorite movie or a favorite song or a favorite band. So it should be no surprise to me or to you all that I don't have a, you know, I don't have like a singular mentor who's like, you know, responsible. Instead, it was the entirety of the cytology faculty at UAB who really sort of sparked that passion, and they each had their strengths and sort of ignited different aspects of the passion for cytopathology for me. Dr. Eltoom, someone from UAB just tweeted a picture of him earlier this week. I was like, oh, Dr. Eltoom, I miss him so. And I didn't realize it until I saw a picture of him. But he has this spark for life in general, and also for, you know, taking care of patients and doing cytopathology. And he's got this glimmer in his eyes when he teaches and when he explains. And so his passion for teaching and for caring for people and for patients, I learned that from him. He also is a very inquisitive man and was exquisitely productive from the research perspective. And so he, in cooperation with several other of the faculty, really helped me in that way. You know, I'm thinking about also Dr. David Cheng. He is quick, efficient. He taught me how to make quick diagnoses, but not based on gut, based on diagnostic criteria. And so when we would sign out PAPs or whatever, we would just quickly rattle off these one word morphological features that were actually diagnostic criteria. So he taught me how to think quickly, how to make, you know, good diagnoses. He's one heck of a researcher. You know, he's got an incredible body of work. And then there was Dr. Darshna Jala, who's, you know, as I was reflecting, I realized her bent was, of course, on patient care, but also providing very safe patient care. And she taught us how to incorporate things that you wouldn't think of doing into your daily practice, you know, to make sure that you're looking at the correct slide, that it's matching up the paperwork, and that, you know, your report, that you're reporting on the proper patient. Of course, this was, I won't tell you how many years ago, so things were a little bit different back then. But I really very much appreciate those skills that she taught me. And then her husband, an equally talented cytopathologist, Dr. Narag Jala, is an exquisite GI pathologist and GI cytopathologist, and taught me a love for and helped me develop expertise in GI cytopathology. And then finally, there was Dr. Ralph Crowe. And he is a very eclectic person, and someone who taught me that it is important to make space in your medical practice for other things that are not medical. So, you know, listening to music, reading books, watching movies. And we would talk about these cultural things during sign out as we were taking care of our patients. So I know that's really long-winded, but I couldn't just say, oh, it was this one person. They all pulled me in, and because they all taught me, you know, different things that I have, you know, taken away and incorporated into who I am today. I'm very grateful for it.
That's wonderful.
That's a wonderful story. So if you had to talk to a medical student who's pathology curious, or a junior resident who is not convinced about their specialty, what would you tell is like the most unique things about cytopathology?
So when one thing I heard when I decided to go into pathology, people said to me, and of course these were not pathologists, they said to me, the medical student who's so excited about going into pathology, oh, the, you know, this is a terrible loss. We're really sorry that you're not going to be taking care of patients, and that you're wasting your talents in pathology. Are you sure about that? And, you know, I'm sure, you know, even medical students today might hear something like that. And, you know, that's frankly really hurtful and offensive. So what I would say is, you know, cytopathology, of all of pathology, is a place that allows you to take care of patients. Of course, all pathologists take care of patients, right? We're all physicians, we're all experts and physicians. We're all taking care of patients, but cytopathology is one of the few aspects of consistent aspects of pathology that is actually patient facing. In that, you know, here at Duke, we have our own freestanding FNA clinic where our patients physically come to us in our clinic, and we see those patients, we interact with those patients, and you know, even if you were to think about it from the perspective of time and time spent, face time spent with a patient, while that amount of time might be minimal, I do believe that we are making very lasting impressions in the lives of those patients. We're meeting patients at their most vulnerable points in their lives. They're frequently afraid because obviously they have some sort of mass, be it palpable or non-palpable. They're experiencing stress, fear, concern. They don't know what that is. You know, some of them are concerned about the potential pain, physical pain that they might endure. Mm-hmm. And so this is, to me, a wonderful opportunity for me to help them to understand who I am as a cytopathologist. I always, you know, make sure they understand that it is I who will be interpreting the material. I also give them results in real time. As long as it's not a new diagnosis of malignancy, if it's a new diagnosis, I generally don't do that. But if it's a recurrence or something like that, I generally do. You know, why are we going to let these patients walk around for, you know, days, potentially, not knowing if their cancer is back? So I think that is a very strong argument for cytopathology, for someone who is concerned about, you know, maybe going into pathology and maybe not having those patient-facing interactions who might really enjoy it. For me, it's just the perfect amount, not too much, not too little. And I like to strive to take an opportunity not only to help the patients, but also to sort of help spread the word about who we are as pathologists and our role on the healthcare team.
Definitely. Those are so many great points and selling points for cytopathology, that it is patient-facing and you are directly impacting patient care. So can you share with us an interesting case that you've come across in your time as a cytopathologist, something that impacted you?
So again, I don't have one specific case in mind. That's probably not a surprise to you. What the memories that I carry with me are more about interactions that I've had with patients. I guess some of the more strong memories I have are of patients who, when I walk in the room, are visibly upset. They could be crying, you know, their body language might be closed. Some of them even tremble with, you know, fear, anxiety. And I take it upon myself to help them come down from that, or I do my best to do that. And so some of my best memories are of, you know, one time I placed my hands on a patient's feet. She was already in the supine position, and I placed my hands on her feet, and I looked her in the eyes and I said, "You look scared." And then that's all I said. And then I let her talk. And within a few minutes, she felt a lot better. And we talked about what she was afraid of. And, you know, she had had a prior experience where, you know, the word she used was traumatic. And I said, "Well, you know, I'm going to be as gentle as I can. You're in control. You're the boss here. And if we need to stop the procedure, we'll stop the procedure. But my goal is, you know, to take care of you in the best way possible and in a gentle manner. And we did. And after, you know, once I finished, she was just singing my praises. Oh my gosh, you're the only person who can ever do my biopsy in the future, you know, that kind of thing. So those to me are highlight moments, like where I really help the patient and when they're really challenging situations. And generally they're challenging from a sort of communications perspective, because that's who I am. That's what I like to do. Of course, I like to diagnose and that, but I tend not to geek out about rare or unusual diagnoses at this point in my career. Earlier in my career, yeah, I did, but now I geek out about different things.
Wow. I feel like you already answered or half answered the question that I'm going to ask you. What, as a cytopathologist in daily practice, what do you find is the most gratifying aspect of your job?
There's so many. I think one of, probably if I had to give the answer, it's in the FNA clinic, seeing the patients, performing the biopsy, establishing that connection, and then going back into the room and saying, here are your preliminary results. My favorite, of course, is when I can give them good news and say, I don't see anything concerning. you know, those are the best days. But, you know, there are, of course, many moments, unfortunately, where I have to say, unfortunately, you know, the malignancy is back. But even that is very fulfilling, because those patients and their family members and friends and, you know, support people that they have with them are always so grateful that that I'm giving them this information, so they don't have to, like, you know, wait for over the weekend or over the night to figure out what's coming in the future. And a lot of times these patients are going right back to the clinic that they came from. And so, you know, I always give them reassurance. Yes, I'm telling you this. I'm going to call Dr. So-and-so. I'm going to tell Dr. So-and-so what the results are. By the time you get back to clinic and get called in, they'll have a plan for you. That's, to me, that's one of the most beautiful things, to be able to help patients in that way.
Oh, wow. That's wonderful. Mm-hmm. So moving gears a little bit, what is the fellowship training like for this specialty and about the board? So for the fellowship, since you're also the fellowship director, how is, at your institute, how is the fellowship program structured for potential fellows?
Mm-hmm. So this is a boarded fellowship, and in general, you, if you're interested in cytopathology, you're going to look for an ACGME accredited fellowship. The ACGME mandates that the fellowships need to be 12 months in length. And then from there, the program directors and institutions can take it upon themselves with a lot of creativity. Of course, there are, you know, certain rules that we have to abide by, but there are general commonalities that all fellowships will have. All fellowships will provide their fellows opportunities to learn to do FNA. So that stands for fine needle aspiration biopsy. I'm realizing I didn't define that earlier. And, you know, for med students, that may not be the top of mind. So it's FNA. And not all places are doing this, but I think many programs are offering both ultrasound guided fine needle aspiration biopsy as well as traditional palpable. At Duke, we do both. And, you know, they're both challenging. Of course, ultrasound guided, I think for me specifically, is more challenging, but it's also more rewarding, especially when you are able to, you know, get a needle in somewhere pretty deep and hit an area that's pretty small. That's a lot of fun. So we're doing FNA, we're doing ROSE, which stands for Rapid On-Site Evaluation of Tissues. And what does that mean? It means that cytopathologists, cytopathology fellows, cytotechnologists, perhaps other physician extenders, residents, med students, maybe if they're shadowing someone, go to any procedure room that is doing an image-guided procedure. For example, could be ultrasound-guided EUS, so like in the GI suite, it could be in the Bronx suite, could be in the radiology suite under ultrasound or CT guidance. What happens is one of us is in there receiving tissues and making smears, and we're also triaging the material and then reviewing the smears that we make under the microscope in real time to provide feedback to the proceduralist. Essentially, we want to let them know whether or not they're hitting the lesion, do they have lesional material, and then if they are in the lesion, a sense of what is it? Is it malignant? Is it infectious? If it's infectious, that's important. You know, we would need to get more to send for culture. Could it be lymphoma? If it's lymphoma, then that's also important. We need to get a specimen and send that for flow cytometry. So these are all the questions that we're addressing during ROSE. Then there's traditional exfoliative cytology, which is where, you know, where it all started, arguably, with Dr. Papanicolaou. And, you know, of course, that's where evaluation of pap smears comes into play, as well as all of the other exfoliative specimens that we look at that you could obtain from, you know, head to toe, basically. And then also other things that you can expect as a fellow to learn on varying degrees, depending upon the program, would be laboratory management, patient safety, quality assurance, and then also well-being. You know, in my program here at Duke, we talk about well-being, and there's, you know, a whole section in my program manual about well-being. So there's a good emphasis on that. Again, it's 12 months. There's a lot of leeway from program to program about how those 12 months are spent. We have electives, so my program offers 3 months of electives, and that's a nice opportunity for the cyto fellows to develop sort of a side interest, mm-hmm. and you know, get some more concentrated experience depending upon what route they're going in their job and what their learning needs are and potential learning gaps are. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, I think I mentioned this, but I just want to say it again in case I didn't mention it. This is a board certified subspecialty. And so after the year of fellowship, you know, near the end, you'll apply to the boards to take the boards. And then generally the boards for subspecialty exams are administered in the early fall. So it coincides within the first few months of your new job or a new fellowship, or if you're doing another fellowship.
Definitely. That sounds amazing with all that hands-on experience too. So what an incredible opportunity. So can you share with us some advice that you have for medical students and residents who are aspiring to go into cytopathology, what they should be thinking about and look into?
Mm-hmm. So if, you know, for people who have already decided that cytopathology is what they want to do, I would say yay and welcome to the club. Learn as much surgical pathology as possible, because it is really important to understand surge path just as much as possible. Also, you know, make sure that you have a good grasp of anatomy, you know, basic anatomy. It doesn't have to be, you know, at the depth that we learned in early in medical school, but, you know, just basic anatomy, because you have to be able to visualize the path of the needle. Other things I would say is join the ASC. And, you know, I'm not as familiar with the ASC committees, but if they do accept junior members on their committees, I would say definitely, you know, sign up for a committee, do volunteer work, start going to the annual meeting. Some of you might be thinking, what is ASC? It's American Society of Cytopathology. And you can join as a resident physician. It might be free. And you might have to have, you know, a cytopathologist to sponsor you. But what a great opportunity to network is what I would think. Is like, if you need a sponsor, then, you know, challenge yourself to go to a cytopathologist you've not worked with and say, I know we haven't worked together, and here's what I'm thinking. You know, would you like to sponsor me? So I would do that. We mentioned Twitter before we started recording, and I think that's how, you know, Abdul, you and I first met was on Twitter. And so I would say if, and the funny thing is, I'm not even a social media person. Twitter is the only thing I do. But I would say, you know, join Twitter. And even if you're, you know, not going to contribute content, that's okay. You can just follow cytopathologists and see what they're saying. And, you know, there's so many people who are putting out really great content from the cytopathology perspective, as well as surgical pathology, really all of pathology. You know, I follow so many different people and I love it because I learn so much. And also, you know, I make these really great connections as well. So that's another piece of advice. Trying to think, what else?
Any resources that you could mention, like other than obviously Twitter?
At the resident level?
Yeah, yeah. Any websites or any modules that you would that people could do?
That's a good question. I know ASC has free cases for mm-hmm. members.
Yeah.
I did those a long time ago, and I haven't looked at them recently. They were great. They were really good. And they actually, ASC has quite a few resources. So once you join, then you should have access to those resources. And they have some that are called Cell Talks. Mm-hmm. That is an abbreviation. And a few years ago, one of my prior fellows and I did one on feedback. So there are these like short snippets, sound bites of, you know, educational content. So those are good resources. I don't know, I'm kind of old school, you know, like for Cyto, I could tell you the textbooks that, you know, that I like and that I always recommend. That is, you know, when you're a resident, Baby DeMay and also Duckettman. Those are the two together. If you read those, as well as all of the diagnostic systems, you have to read all of those too. When I was a fellow, it was really simple. You know, we had the original Bethesda system as well as, you know, those books. And that was what you needed. Of course, you know, when you're a fellow, I think that you need to read all of Big DeMay, cover to cover, as well as Duckettman. I'm sure there are probably a lot of great newer textbooks out there. But one thing I've realized is that as we sort of move through our career paths, our learning needs change and the content that we turn to changes. And also I think technology shapes that as well. So I'm probably showing my my age a little bit with this answer, but that's okay.
That's all right. So we also know that you are interested in medical education and you co-edited an issue of the archives a few months ago, I believe, or probably it was last year. Can you tell us how you got interested in medical education and if someone is like, how does one pursue that particular passion within academic medicine?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I have always loved teaching. And if I think back, you know, to my childhood, you know, some kids would play with dollies and dress them up and do their hair. Well, what I did was I put them in a circle or a semicircle. It's so true. And I had a dry erase marker board and I would come home and I would teach to my stuffed animals and to my dolls. Legit. Like, yeah, it was. And so, you know, when I got to medicine and joined faculty here at Duke, I realized, wow, you know, I really love working with residents, working with fellows, and now it's transitioned to more working with faculty. I'm sort of a shapeshifter, as it were, and I love to sort of, you know, learn a skill and then keep moving. But what I like to do is teach people and help people and explain things and help them to figure out what's going on. So I guess it's just always been there, you know, in looking back, you know, that's a pretty odd thing to play as a kid, but it's very true. So how did I do it? That's another question, especially like at the time when I made the decision to sort of switch my career from like HPV P16 work over to medical education. I was really the only person in my department who wanted to do that. Who, I mean, of course there were other educators in the department, but they weren't trying to get promoted based on their work in education. So I had to look outside the department for that and look at educational leaders at the institution. And so I was able to make some connections through the GME office. And then shortly after I made this switch, it was fortuitous for me that Duke decided to create an educational academy called Duke Ahead, which is just this terrific interprofessional group of educators that provides a nice community. And they also provide, you know, it has grown over the years, and they provide all sorts of educational content for us, professional development. There are many grants that we can apply for to get monies, like for coaching. I did that one time. They also fund education research. So that was a really great thing that helped me along my way. And then just, you know, finding other pathology educators nationwide, that was also really critical. And, you know, sort of joining that network. So, you know, for people who are interested in education, I would say, you know, first look within the department, you know, who are the educational leaders, let it be known that you're interested. I would also look at the institutional level, look to see if your institution has an educational academy similar to Duke Ahead. There's some GME programs that are creating these like sort of specialized tracks, and Duke over the years has had one that is designed for developing skills in medical education. And I'm sure that other institutions have something similar as well. So I would say, you know, if you're a resident and fellow, look to your GME office to see if they have something like that that you could do. Generally, you know, you're going to do that as a more advanced resident because it's additional work, of course, and your program director will likely have to endorse you signing on to do this extra work, but it's well worth it. So those would be my pieces of advice. Another thing, you know, we talked about volunteerism through the ASC. Of course, the ASC is not the only society that you can volunteer for. There are all sorts of national societies. And I know the CAP accepts junior volunteers because I primarily volunteer with the CAP, not because that's just, you know, that's I made this connection with the CAP long, long, long time ago. And I'm big on well-being and, you know, realistically assessing my bandwidth. And I simply do not have the bandwidth to be one of those people who's at every meeting, you know, for every society and volunteering like that. So I've had to make some difficult choices. Having said that, the CAP does welcome juniors, and the CAP has a Council on Education. And under the Council of Education are several education-related committees. And so those are really great opportunities for residents to get a feel for, you know, educational leadership. From that perspective as well.
Oh, that's wonderful. Yeah, that's great. That's awesome. Yeah, you mentioned earlier about you guys did a cell talk on feedback. And so I just want to sort of get more of your, like, what more can you tell us about the developing soft skills in trainees? And do you guys do that at your program? And how do you guys do that at your program? That's also what I wanted to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so in our fellowship program, I have a recording of me giving a talk about feedback. And during the boot camp, which is happens like essentially as soon as orientation is completed. All of the incoming fellows are asked to watch that video, and then we'll sort of debrief about any questions they have. Myself, as well as some of the other faculty here, really value a culture of feedback. And what I mean by that is like both ways. So, you know, I'm going to give very honest feedback, and I expect the fellows will give me as an educator honest feedback, as well as when I'm, you know, when we're talking about the program, I really want to know from the fellows what's working well and what's not working well. And I'm fortunate to say that, you know, the fellows in general are willing to give me feedback. I think it's because they know I care and that I'm listening, and that, you know, if there is something that's easily actionable and makes sense, I'm gonna fix it, you know, whatever it is that they come up with.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Meredith, do you have anything?
I don't have any further questions, but I just think it's great all the work you're doing, and I'm excited for you know, to learn more about medical education as I go through you know, forward into residency here soon. So yeah, thank you for sharing your story with us, and we're looking forward to share with everybody else.
Yeah. So that's our show for today, folks. You can find Dr. Bean on Twitter. Her Twitter handle is at Dr. SM Bean. She is also sometimes active on Kiko. And thank you very much for listening to us. If you like the show, please like and subscribe to our channels on YouTube, Apple, and Podbean. We will be back with another episode soon.
Special thank you to our listeners. Until next time, enjoy this excerpt from an upcoming interview with Dr. Leland Pantanowitz.
And then you will always run into some regulatory hurdles, either it's FDA or you know, whatever the other regulation is required in that country. And it was the same story told around the world over and over over time. And so, yeah, the most exciting thing is that finding that technology and applying it to the practice of pathology every day. And we're undergoing that now with digital pathology, right? So, especially post-COVID, a lot of us are burnt out. People want to work from home. What if the next pandemic arrives? We're not prepared. So we need to get onto a digital platform. So, you know, how do we solve that problem? We need to get onto a virtual platform to do that. And the silver lining is, if you're on a virtual platform, guess what? You can start to have apps that can do artificial intelligence and start to use them and so on. So, you know, I think you can be creative in your job if you know how to apply technology successfully.